In 1553, the aging Michelangelo sits with his devoted pupil and biographer Ascanio Condivi, ready to reveal the true story of his life. At 78, the master sculptor, painter, and poet has witnessed the glory and corruption of Renaissance Italy and endured profound spiritual turmoil. He begins to recount his journey to Ascanio, from his early struggles with faith to his encounter with Martin Luther's revolutionary gospel. Michelangelo shares the story of his soul. As with any life devoted to capturing the sacred in stone and paint, sometimes, when you least expect it, there's darkness.
I was three, Ascanio, perched on my father's shoulders in the Piazza della Signoria. Oh, I remember it. The purple gown and the stocking legs of Jacopo de Pazzi as he hung before us. There he was, a man who should have been walking and talking and breathing, but now he dangles as an object. Huh? It was just surreal. And it was at that moment when the rain started to fall. Dark sheets pounded the earth for 4 days, as if heaven was angry. Meanwhile, that image, that memory of Jacopo, it just burrowed into my mind. What did I do? I mean, what could I do? I was three. I would dream, and then I would draw. I would dream of escaping the shadows somehow. In the coming years, I would sit before those glorious gates of Ghiberti, the gates of paradise on the baptistry. I would see the Ark of Salvation coming at me and wonder, how do I get into that world beyond the shadows? Now, the day came when I entered through those gates. It was my brother's baptism. You walk in, and there before you is the Last Judgment fresco, Jesus enthroned, surrounded by ranks of angels and apostles and saints. And then down below, you have the damned ushered into hell. It's beautiful, and it's frightening. It was then my older brother, Leonardo, he was 8, I was 6. He noticed that wherever we walked inside of the baptistry, the eyes of Jesus seemed to follow us. He said this out loud, and our younger brother, Buonarroto, heard him. Oh, he became frightened. He began to hide behind our relatives, trying to evade those eyes. And soon we found him crouching beside the baptismal font. You know, the great big stone octagonal font. I looked at him, and I thought, how silly. How silly to think that stone can shield you from the gaze of God. Well, our family traveled home, and I was so excited to tell my mother about the fresco. When I got home, I was surprised that she didn't come out to see us. My father said she needed rest, having just given birth. And so there she was for a whole day. And the next day, and then the third day, and then we lost her. I don't talk about my mother very much, Ascanio. I don't remember very much. What do I remember? I remember crawling into her lap, her warm arms around me, looking into her face, that smile, how it radiated peace and serenity. Well, that changed everything. My father sent me to grammar school. Grammar school. Our teacher would stand up, and he would announce, Equus magnus est. We would have to translate our Latin. The horse is large. And then we would do our declensions and conjugations. You know, much of the time, I was drawing in the corner of my parchment a horse or a bell tower or whatever. The day came when I went home, and I told my father, I said, Papa, school is great, but I'm an artist. I want to be a scultore, a sculptor. He just stared at me. He didn't say a word. And then he slapped me in the face. He said, you, a scultore, huh? With a dust in your hair and the paint on your clothing? No, you will be a banker. You are a Buonarroti. You see, our family, the Buonarroti, we came from nobility. For generations, we walked through Florence with our chins held high, proud of our noble heritage. Now, things were different. We were hovering somewhere over the working class. It was at that point, he pointed at me, and he said, Michelangelo, you no defy me. My father could be very stubborn, but not as stubborn as me. So I went out to draw and to paint with my friend Francesco Granacci. We went to the workshop of Domenico Ghirlandaio, and there we learned how to mix paint and prepare fresco. And it was Domenico who went to my father and said, Lodovico, your son Michelangelo, he's an artist. This is how God created him. And finally, my father relented. Well, it wasn't long before I was living in the home of Lorenzo de' Medici. How? He and my father are distant cousins, so he pulled some strings, and there I was, in the palazzo of Il Magnifico himself. Now, you want to talk about an education. Imagine this. Sitting over here is Marsilio Ficino, the philosopher who translated Plato. And over here, Angelo Poliziano, the poet who would weave together words like silk. And over here, Cristofolo Landino, whose commentary on Dante opened a window to a whole new world. I remember one day, I was in the gardens of San Marco when Lorenzo came over. And he said, Michelangelo, come and see. And he showed me this marble, beautiful, highly polished marble. We could see our reflection in it. And as the sun shone down on it, the light it danced around the edges. He pointed to the light and he said, Il divino, the divine. Every piece of beauty reveals the divine. Ah, that was the moment when I decided my life would be all about producing beauty. Every brushstroke, every chisel mark would lift men and women heavenward, another rung on the ladder of perfection. Ah, those Medici. Who's that? Giovanni? Ah, Giovanni, son of Lorenzo. He would become Pope Leo X, the pope who would excommunicate Martin Luther and begin the Protestant Reformation. We were born the same year, but that's where our similarities ended. Ciccione, we called him. He was very particular. He liked his silk shirts, and he liked his perfumes. He liked to eat. Mamma mia. We used to say he was 10 pounds of sausage in a 5-pound casing. I mean, when he sat around the house, he sat around the house, you know what I mean? In fact, one time I told a joke to Ficino. I said, Marsilio, I'm getting a little concerned about Giovanni. I think he's developing Kaleida. And Ficino said, che cosa? What is Kaleida? I said, Kaleida is a condition in which one's thighs are so chunky that they collide together whenever you walk. Ficino thought it was hilarious. Giovanni, not so much. But you know, he wasn't the only pope to be. We also had his cousin, Giulio, who'd be Clement VII, the pope who would see the sack of Rome. Now, he was different. He wasn't at all entitled. He was kind and gentle. But he was so indecisive. I remember on one cold winter's day, he had a black coat and a brown coat. And he could not decide which coat to wear. He just kept vacillating and dithering. And finally, he left the house without any coat, and he shivered. Now, as you well know, Ascanio, that quality of indecision would prove to be tragic in the history of Christendom. Well, enough about the Medici. You asked me about my art. What would you like to know? No, you can't ask me that. I can't tell you my favorite piece, huh? My artwork is like my offspring, the children I never had. Okay? Ah, the Pietà. Never in all of my life did I touch a piece of marble as beautiful as the Pietà. It's like it fell out of heaven down into the caves of Carrara. There I wanted to carve intimacy, you know, a love of a mother for her son. And so there is her crucified son in her lap, her warm arms around him, her face emanating peace and serenity despite the anguish. That's the Pietà. The David. Well, you know, in so many ways, the David was just the opposite. This was a piece of marble many considered unworkable. It had been outside in the courtyard of the Duomo for decades. It was exceedingly long, over 17 feet. They called it Il Gigante. And one time, I heard someone say, not even Michelangelo can work with this stone. Well, let the games begin, right? So here I decided I would carve courage. I wanted that moment right before the battle, you know, when Goliath is pointing his finger toward David's face, saying, I defy the armies of the Lord. And just then, David is going to reach for his sling and his stone, and you could see in his eye his courage. Already he's singing, Vincerò, I will win, I will conquer. That's my David. The ceiling of the Sistino, ah. You know, I told Julius, I said, I'm not a painter. I'm a scultore. You need to find someone else. But when the Pope tells you to paint, you paint. So there I was for 4 years on my scaffold, 60 feet in the air with my neck craning back. What was it like? Arduous, painful. I still have the scars to prove it. I wrote something about it. It was right after I finished. I described what the experience felt like. You want to hear that, huh? All right, tell you what, I'll read it, but this does not go into the biography. Capisce? All right, let's see here. Wait a while. All right, I got it. Upon the scaffold, my beard toward heaven, I feel the back of my brain, my brush above my face continually, making it a canvas painted by what falls. My lower back jammed into my stomach, my rear sticks out like a counterweight, and when I climb down, I am half blind. The message? You want to know the message? You know, it's interesting. I hear this question often. What's the ceiling all about? And I understand. There's a lot going on up there. You have prophets and sibyls and the ancestors of Christ, the ignudi. It's about returning to innocence. When you walk through the doors of the chapel, what do you see just above you? You see Noah. He's drunk. He's naked. He's full of shame. Ah, that's our story. That's all of us. That's our leaders in Rome, Sixtus IV, Alexander VI, with all of their lust and their pride. That is, if I may say, also Julius II, the Pope who preferred the smell of gunpowder over incense. But you know, it's all of us. We go our own way, and we got to get back to the garden where we walked with God. And so if you compare my Noah with Adam, you see them in the same posture. Except Noah is a tired, broken down, compromised version of what humanity is supposed to be. Well, it wasn't long after I completed the ceiling that Julius II died. And that was a momentous event because then my old friend Giovanni became Pope. He took the name Leo. And what do you suppose he did for me? After I painted heaven itself upon his ceiling. Everyone in Rome is calling me Il Divino, the Divine One. A bit audacious, I'll grant you that. But what did Giovanni do? He turned to his darling from Urbino, Raphael. with his soft collars and his genteel, courtly manners. Huh? He's getting all the attention, all the accolades. Me, I'm chipping away at Julius's tomb, that albatross around my neck, that never-ending tragedy. But then, unexpectedly, Leo comes to me with a new commission. He wants me to carve the grand facade of San Lorenzo, the great church of the Medici. Wow. Now, if you thought the David raised the currency of the Buonarroti, just wait to see what a project of this size would do. So I got busy. I found the best marble. I produced endless sketches. I even created a wooden model that I sent to Leo in Rome. This thing was happening. It was taking shape. But then, out of nowhere, he withdraws the commission. He sent his messenger from Rome. And he told me there's no longer funding and the project is finished, just like that. I stared at him in stunned silence. What did this mean? What would this do for my family, my friends, for all of Florence? I was insulted. I was humiliated. I was ruined. My life was like the broken pieces of marble all around me. What happened to it? The marble? Well, all that marble went to the next project, the sacristy, that is the mausoleum or the funeral monument for Giuliano and Lorenzo. And there I carved night and day and dawn and dusk. And I realized I wasn't the only one in grief, though, that this was my funeral. Yes, this was my lament. But the song of sorrow would soon extend all the way down to Rome, indeed, to all of Christendom, because Leo would soon die. 1521, and he would be succeeded by Adrian VI, and then Julio as Clement VII. And we see his indecision on display for all the world to behold. Because on one side, he had Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, and on the other side, he had Francis I of France, and he just couldn't decide with whom to align. He kept vacillating and shifting and giving mixed messages. And he infuriated them both. And the result? Destruction. The sack of Rome. The combined forces of the Spanish and German pikemen came down upon the eternal city and laid waste to it. There was blood in the streets and rape and pillage. Rome wasn't simply destroyed. It was buried alive, and Clement could do nothing. There he stood in his Castle Sant'Angelo as a prisoner, looking on in horror. It was then we remembered the voice of the preacher, Savonarola, from my childhood in Florence. How many times did he say, "The day is coming when God will judge unholy Rome," and indeed, he did. But you know, strangely, we were rejoicing in Florence because for us it meant freedom, huh? No longer under the domain of the Medici, whom we exiled. Now we could reestablish the Republic. And so I ran into the piazza with everyone else, waving our flags, crying out, "Libertà, libertà." This was our moment. So we got to work. We started to build our reserves and strengthen the walls, develop strategies for how we could protect ourselves, because we knew it was just a matter of time before some army arrived at our door. Clement was down, but he wasn't out. And so every able-bodied man came to Florence. Even the farmers from the field came in. But eventually, we began to see how we were unwittingly sowing the seeds of our own destruction, because without farmers working in the fields, there was a lack of food. That led to starvation. And that famine led to plague. And pretty soon, people were dying in the streets, men, women, and children. I said to my brother, Buonarroto, I said, "You need to just leave. Go to our family farm in Settignano. Don't talk to anyone. Just go. And then I waited. And I waited. I waited. And then I learned that he had become ill. You know, too soon, Escanio. We lost him too soon. Then we found ourselves in real trouble. I composed these words on that very day for my brother. I said, "Therefore, my little boat will not cross over to see you, my dear brother. I remain here. Cruel mercy and merciless grace left me alive and cut you off from me, breaking but not extinguishing our bond. In my grief, I continued to work, trying my best to strengthen Florence. It was one day I was walking across the Piazza della Signoria, and I saw a man. I'd never seen him before. He had this almost maniacal look in his eye. He stared at me, and then he went like this. And I learned someone had hired an assassin to take my life. So that night, I left on horseback for Venice, avoiding Bologna, the papal city. Two of my friends joined me. Just a few days later, we arrived. The Venetian government offered me lodging, but I refused. I needed to keep my head low, stay incognito. So I found an apartment in a poor neighborhood across from the canal at San Marco. That was a fearful and lonely time. But you know, as I'm walking down the street, who do I see but my old friend, Antonio Bruccioli. Ah, Antonio. We were friends from childhood in Florence. He was just the person I needed in that moment after losing my brother. And so we sat down and we caught up and we shared old stories. And he reminded me of things I had forgotten. Like that time we snuck into his nonna's kitchen and we took some biscotti that had just been made. We carried those cookies down into the piazza. They were so good that we couldn't resist eating them as we went, but there was his nonna, like a Dominican inquisitor. She found the crumbs and she followed them, and sure enough, she found us in the piazza, red-handed. Those were good days with Antonio. One night, I went into his study. He had candles all around him, parchments laid out. I said, "Antonio, what are you doing at this hour, huh?" He said, "I'm working." I said, "What are you working on?" He looked at me, or better yet, he looked through me. He said, "I'm translating the Bible into Italian, and I'm writing a preface to a work by Martin Luther." I said, "What's the urgency?" He said, "We need to get this message of Christ out to the people. It must be proclaimed." I said, "Antonio, do we not have the message of Christ?" He looked at me again with that look. And he said, "Michelangelo, look at us here. We're a couple of exiles in hiding, huh? That's what humanity's like, hiding from God. Well, like Adam and Eve in the garden. Remember how they hid? And then they tried to cover their shame with those pathetic fig leaves? We're no different. We hide behind other things, like marble and paint, or maybe our name. God calls us to step out of hiding, to move out from the shadows and into the light of his presence so that his gaze can fall upon us, huh? To appear exposed and bare, naked even. Michelangelo, you know, naked. You painted all over the place. We're supposed to stand before God. And in that moment, when he sees our guilt and our shame, it feels as if we will be struck dead. And that's when he directs us to look over here at the man hanging on the cross, naked. That man, the Son of God, shed his blood. His blood that is the only true solvent for our guilt. Michelangelo, that's the good news. God made him who knew no sin to become sin for us, so that we, sinners, might become the righteousness of God in him. Well, he gave me a lot to think about that night. I went to sleep. I'm not sure I slept at all. The next day, we were awoken to a knock at the door. We sent Bruno to go get it. Always a good idea for Bruno to get the door. And it was a messenger from the government of Florence, the Signoria, with a message for me. He looked right at me and he said, "Michelangelo Donorotti, you must return to Florence at once. Otherwise, your property will be confiscated and you will be an outlaw for the rest of your life." Then he put a letter down on the table and left. What was I to do? I took that letter and I walked across the street to the canal. I looked in the water, this tug of war in my soul. If I returned home, it would mean a certain death. But how could I not return? All I had worked for, all my effort, and the Buonarroti name and honor were at stake. So that day, I left for Florence. I returned just as the imperial and papal armies were tightening the noose around the city. I made it through the walls like a shadow, and then the battle. Oh, I remember, Scagno, the cannonballs crashing against the walls, the cathedral bells tolling, the mothers holding their children, the babies crying, and then the siege. For months, we were starving, and then finally, we were defeated. Not because of the walls I designed, mind you, they held up, but because of treachery. There was a traitor in our midst. Well, now I had a dozen assassins coming after me, and I would have surely died if not for the kind prior of San Lorenzo. He said to me, "Michelangelo, you come, I will protect you. I will hide you." So we found this room, and I remember kneeling in prayer in that place, calling out to God, and on one occasion, I could hear the footsteps of the assassins just outside the door, and I thought, this was it. And I called out to God, I said, "Oh, Lord, have mercy upon me. Hear my cry. Pull me up from the miry pit and set my feet upon a rock and make my footsteps firm." And I waited and I waited. The men went away. I was safe. The Lord had delivered me. Well, there I was for a number of weeks. And then eventually, Clement, true to his name, extended clemency to me, pardon. And I was free. What did I do? I went back to work. I was working in Rome on Julius's tomb, and then I was back in Florence working on the sacristy, going back and forth. But that was the time when Clement approached me about a new project, the Last Judgment fresco on the altar wall in the Sistine. I hadn't been in the Sistine Chapel years. It had been nearly 25 years since I painted the ceiling. And as I painted, I remembered what Antonio had told me. And I realized I needed to do that painting because that's how I put ideas together in my artwork. I wanted a Last Judgment that had Jesus in the center. And this would be different. This would not have the intercession of Mary or the clerical structure, or purgatory, the common elements to a Last Judgment. No, this would have Christ high and lifted up. And he would be surrounded by all of humanity, naked, exposed, bare before God. Oh, how they criticized me. "Why did he have to draw genitalia on the saints?" they said. "He's turned the most sacred chapel in all of Christendom into a bathhouse. They don't understand, stonado. That's the whole point, you see? We are exposed. We are laid bare. We are naked before this God. Even the saints, while they are righteous, they're also sinners. And in the middle of that cacophony, I put my own face on the flayed skin of St. Bartholomew, that relic from Wittenberg, Germany. Because that's who I am, you know? My best attempts at righteousness, my most heroic acts, are but filthy rags in the sight of this holy God. And then finally, there is Jesus. That face, not a face of anger, but a face of mercy, of compassion. He's looking to his left toward the unrighteous as they are headed toward hell, waiting for one of them to turn in repentance toward him as the heart of God. Well, the last judgment was a moment in which I began to understand. No, it wasn't the turning point. It was a step forward, but I was still processing. It's hard for me to put into words, Escanio, but perhaps this is helpful. Years ago, I had been in the mines of Carrara looking for marble, and I was way in the back, and suddenly a breeze came and it extinguished my lantern, and now I'm surrounded by darkness. And I remember for how many hours I'm crawling through those caves before I got to the exit. And as I stood there at the exit and I looked out into the bright sunshine, my eyes, they just blinked and blinked, trying to see, trying to get perspective on my surroundings. That's where I was when I painted The Last Judgment. I had come through so much darkness. I now saw something of God's redemptive light, but didn't fully understand it. I wrote about this. I remember at this very time, I sent a letter to a friend, and I think these words give expression to what I was experiencing at the time, this longing, this yearning, this desire to encounter God. I said to him, I don't know where I might open a door to grace so that it can spread within my heart and chase out all of my pride. Oh Lord, send that promised light which we will someday see so that my heart may burn free from any doubt and feel only you. Well, that was the time when Vittoria Colonna invited me to a Bible study at San Silvestro in Capite in Rome. Sweet Vittoria, she was my singular friend, my guide, my muse, my Beatrice, who would take me by the hand and bring me into the divine light. So there we were listening to Romans as it was lectured, and then we would retreat to the garden and we would discuss it with friends, you know. And I told Vittoria, I said, I can so identify with Paul. The good thing I want to do, I don't do. Instead, I do the very thing I wish to avoid. And she just looked at me with those eyes, those beautiful eyes. She said, Michelangelo, do you not remember what we studied just a few weeks ago in Romans chapter 6, verse 23? The wages of sin is death, yes, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus. It was that word, gift, the beneficio di Cristo, the approval or favor of God that we can never obtain through our effort. When I heard that word, my eyes stopped blinking. I got it. It made sense. Well, that was the time when Pope, the subsequent Pope, you know who I'm talking about, Pope Paul III, he came up to me. And he said, Michelangelo, I want you to paint in my chapel two frescoes, one on each side. And I decided the first painting would be Saul on the road to Damascus. You remember the story, Ascanio. He gets letters from the Sanhedrin, and he's marching off to find these Christians, these followers of the way. And on the road, he encounters the risen Christ. "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Who are you, Lord?" "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." And in that moment, everything changed for Saul. He was blind, and yet the eyes of his heart were opened. He could see. That was me. Suddenly, I understood who God was. I understood that there was nothing I could do to secure his favor. But his grace and mercy were given to me as a gift. And so in this fresco, I have Jesus reaching down out of heaven. You see him extending his hand of love. And how many critics reminded me of what the masters say. Never draw Jesus in foreshortened form. It's undignified. He should be on a throne in splendor, not reaching over like this. But isn't that God? Isn't that the father of the prodigal? When he sees his son coming from a distant land, he runs to him in the most undignified manner imaginable, and he embraces his son, and he weeps upon him, puts a ring on his finger, a robe on his back. That's how Jesus had reached out to me, or rather down to me. And so I have a singular line of redemptive love extending from his hand to the heart of Paul, and there I put my face on Saul of Tarsus, because that was my story. I had been made new. Well, as is so often the case in life, our greatest joys are often followed by our deepest sorrows. I had heard that Vittoria wasn't doing very well, so I made my way down to Rome and to where she was at the palazzo. It became clear she didn't have much longer. So we friends, we stayed with her. We kept vigil. And then there was the day. It was clear she would be closing her eyes for the last time. So there we were, several of us around her bed. And we all took turns. Someone read a scripture. Another person prayed a prayer. To my left was Marco Antonio Flaminio, the poet. He had prepared a sonnet for her. "'Tis at the trees that fills the breeze with its warm and magical perfume. But oh no, it is not the trees. It is the beautiful Marquesa, the woman of virtue." And then it was my turn. What was I to do? I thought about bringing a drawing, but what good would that do? All I really wanted to do in that moment was to kiss her brow. And so I stepped forward. But as I drew closer, I lost my nerve. And instead of kissing her face, I just kissed her hand. Ascanio, that's one of my biggest regrets in life. Well, with Vittoria gone, I began to think about my own mortality. I started to sculpt my own funeral monument, my penultimate pietà, the lamentation on the sorrow of the crucifixion. And here I have Jesus and Mary, and in front of them is Mary Magdalene, and then behind is Nicodemus. And there on Nicodemus I put my face because, well, that's me. I worked for 6 popes. What was I going to say about my faith? Oh, but I believed. And so like the great undercover believer of Jesus' day, there I was. I realized in that moment, that's the lesson, as I was carving that face. Because all my life, reaching back to Dante and Landino, I had tried so hard to climb that mountain, Mount Purgatorio. And hopefully at the top, I would see beauty. I would find Beatrice and salvation. That's the gate of paradise, all the way up there. And I worked so hard trying to create perfection day after day, week after week, month after month, not knowing whether I would be accepted by this God. And then I finally realized it, that we don't climb in order to reach God. No. Beauty came down to us, and he dwelt among us. We beheld him, the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And in the fullness of time, he went to the cross. He extended his hands and he invited nails of divine judgment in. And that's where we find beauty. That's the purgation for humanity. The light of the knowledge, the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. That, Ascanio, is my story. That's my divine comedy. Recently, I wrote a poem. I suppose this says it best, so I'll leave you with these words, my dear friend. The voyage of my life has reached across a stormy sea in a fragile boat, the final port to give an account for every deed. So now I recognize how laden with error was the fantasy that made artistic beauty an idol and sovereign to me. What will become of all my thoughts of love, my hopes, my dreams? No chisel, no brush can soothe my soul anymore. Only that divine love who stretched wide his arms upon the cross to take us in. There, and only there, I found myself. Amen.